So we finished chapter three yesterday. We're going to move on to a new topic, which is often comes up in our lives today, which is about when you move between places that have different customs. And you'll see that it starts off being about Pesach, makes a sort of sidestep into other topics, and then we'll eventually get back to Pesach. Again, we're going through the chronological order of the day. So we just talked about various things that could be chametz, what kind of dough is chametz versus what kind of dough is not chametz, and then we ended up so we've gone through that sort of thing, and now we're still talking about the 14th and sort of going through the day, so we're just trying to work out what you can do on the 14th. So that's where we are now. Mishnah 1. So the Mishnah is testifying to a multitude of practices that some people, some regions of Eretz Israel would only do normal work until midday on the morning of Pesach, on the 14th, and other people would not do any work at all in other places. So what they're saying is, if you happen to be in a place where the custom is that they only do work until midday, then you can do work until midday. But if you're in a place where the custom is not generally to do work at all, then you shouldn't do any work at all. This presumably is to give people a chance to prepare for Pesach. There's a lot to do, as I'm sure many of us know. And honestly, I could imagine giving us the whole week before Pesach, but nonetheless, we have a day or minimally an afternoon to make sure to prepare by forgetting about all our daily work. So that's just laying up the situation, that there is a spread of practices depending on your region. Now, haholeich mimakom she'osin lemakom she'ein osin, or mimakom she'ein osin lemakom she'osin, not nin alav chumrei makom she'yatza misham v'chumrei makom she'halach lesham. Now, imagine you're in one place, and then where they don't do work at all on that day, and then you end up in a place where they actually would do work until midday. What do you do? Answer is, you have to follow the chumrei makom she'yatza misham v'chumrei makom she'halach lesham. You end up making the stringent choice, both no matter where you came from. So in other words, if you switch region, whether you came from a place that where there was no work done and you went to a place where people worked until midday, or vice versa, you would not be able to work at all. So this is a slightly sort of odd way of saying this, because there's really only one chumrah at play here, right? There's not a either you're going from a place which is more lenient to a place which is more stringent, or from a place which is more stringent to a place which is more lenient. The only stringent factor here is that you should not do any work on the 14th of Nisan. So you'll see why in a second, because as we're about to veer into other topics, this phrasing is, I think, supposed to be specifically general, because we're about to generalize it to other cases. And even more so, we're sort of going to get a reason behind what's going on, though there are other ways you could understand this line. Va'al yishaneh adam mipnei hamachloket. A person shouldn't change the practice because of machloket, because of disagreements or quarrels. We're used to thinking of machloket as a value, machloket l'shem shamayim, an argument for the sake of heaven. This kind of machloket is sort of intercommunal strife, or people assume that you're not keeping the laws. This is a bad kind of machloket, which the Mishnah talks about in a few places. So fundamentally, the point is that there's a spread of practice as to which work you're allowed to do on Pesach, and you have to follow the stringencies if you move around. And I think that the custom for today is to work until midday. Now we're going to move on to another sort of similar topic that relates to regions, and if you are going to move from one region to another. Kayotsevo, similarly, hamolich peirot shvid mimkom shekalu limkom shelo chalu, or mimkom shelo chalu limkom shekalu, chayav levayer. So this requires a little bit of background about shvi'it, seventh year produce. The rubric is that you can't keep the shvi'it produce in your house, and the rubric of when you have to get rid of it is, and it's no longer available in the fields. So if it's no longer available in the fields for animals to eat, then you also have to get it out of your house. Now, that therefore might be different depending on where you are. There might be crops stay in one region longer than in another region. So that's what we're talking about. Hamolich peirot shvi'it mimakom shekalu. You brought fruit fruit which are seventh year produce, which is unavailable for you to eat, from a place where they have finished in the fields to a place where they have not finished in the fields, or from vice versa, a place where they've not finished to a place they have finished. Chayav lavayer, you have to take it out of your house. Just like you have to get rid of chametz, exactly the same word, bi'or chametz, exactly as we learned about in the previous, in chapter two. This is, you have to get rid of the shvi'it produce. It can't be in your house. It's ownerless. You can't own it. And having it in your house would be a sign of ownership. So again, you're going to end up doing the chumrah regardless. If the fruit came from a place where you're not allowed to have it in your house, but where you happen to end up is a place where you can have it in your house, you have to take it out of your house. And if you came from a place where you could have it in your house and you went to a place where you couldn't have it in your house, you have to take it out of your house. Regardless, you're going to have to take it out of your house. Okay. But Rabbi Yehuda seems to have a dissenting opinion. There's a whole bunch of ways to understand this line. I'm going to interpret this line, which I think is the base sense of the Mishnah, and it basically requires you to ignore the words Omrim Lo, which we're about to read. You basically have to ignore those words, I think, to understand this line. It helps that it's not in all of the texts of the Mishnah. If you look in manuscripts, some manuscripts omit the words Omrim Lo. So I'm going to translate it basically without that word, because I think that's the cleanest sense. But if you look in the Gemara, you'll see interpretations that try to explain it with the words Omrim Lo in a more sort of convoluted fashion. So Rabbi Yehuda dissents. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, say v'havelach af ata. If somebody comes along at you and says, hey, what are you doing with that shvi'id produce? Don't you need to get rid of it? Don't you know that you're supposed to, it's out of the fields here. Why do you have that produce? You can say to that person, you could just go to where I came from and you can get that food. Like, you can just keep it if you just go to where I came from, right? Say v'havelach afata. You could also go to the place that I came from where it's still in the fields, and then it's totally fine. So he seems to reject this idea that you would have to follow the stringent position regardless of where you came from. If you came from a place where the fruit was allowed in your house, you can just say, hey, you're upset at me for keeping the fruit in my house. Let me tell you, you could go back to where I came from, to my town. You would be able to keep it in your house. So we could all do it. So there's no reason for me to follow the stringent positions when you could, in fact, follow the lenient positions if you wanted. Bit of a sidetrack into seventh year produce. And now we're going to get another sidetrack into other questions, which is about sort of selling things to non-Jews. In Mishnah 3, Makom shenehagu limkor behima zaka lagoyim mochrin. Makom shelo nehagu limkor ein mochrin. So now we learn that there are some places where they had the custom of allowing the sale of small animals to non-Jews. And if you're in one of those places, you can, of course, continue to sell your animals to non-Jews. But there are other places where they don't generally sell small animals to non-Jews. This is like goats or sheep or something like that. And in those places, you shouldn't sell them. Seems like the selling animals to non-Jews is probably some kind of concern about your animals are required to rest with you on Shabbat. And if you sold them to non-Jews, they would end up working on Shabbat. So you're sort of like reducing the amount of Shabbat practice. And certainly if you were to lend them to non-Jews, then you still owned the animal, even though the non-Jew would presumably work them on Shabbat. And that would be a huge problem, a violation of Shabbat. So it seems like that's part of the concern here, is about making sure that you don't reduce the amount of rest your animals have by selling them away to people who would make them work on Shabbat. But nonetheless, some people thought that selling those small animals was fine, because presumably the small animals are not used for large labor, like plows and things. The small animals are more likely to be used for food, and therefore you have a less concern of them working the animal on Shabbat. Because it's about to say, uvechol makom ein mochrin lahem behima gasa. Doesn't matter where you are, in every place, you should not sell them larger animals like cows or oxen, nor should you sell agalim usiachim, which are young calves and young donkeys, because presumably they are small animals now, but in the future they will be large animals. So you're still basically allowing them to do work on Shabbat, creating situations where they would have to do work on Shabbat. And then shleimin ushvurin. Also, it doesn't matter if the animals are totally healthy, they're shleimin, or they are in some way maimed, they're shvurin, they don't walk properly or something like that. You might think that maimed animals would be fine because they're not suitable for work. But this first opinion says not even the lame animals which are not suitable for work. Might be that the first opinion here thinks if you're allowing people to sell maimed animals, then there's people are not going to know the distinction. They're just going to think that you can just sell animals to non-Jews. So it seems like the first opinion would rather disallow people from selling maimed animals in order that they never come to sell non-maimed animals. But Rabbi Yehuda matir bashvura. But Rabbi Yehuda allows one to sell a maimed animal, presumably because the maimed animal is unlikely to do any work and probably will be used for food. Ben Batira matir basus. And the Tanakh Ben Batira, he allows you to sell horses to non-Jews, presumably because horses don't get used in that kind of large-scale labor of plows and things. That's more like oxen. But what they do get used for is riding. You assume that a horse is going to be ridden. And riding on Shabbat, while it is forbidden, it's not such a core violation of Shabbat. It's only a rabbinic prohibition. So it seems like Ben Batira allows you to sell horses to non-Jews because they'll only make the horse violate a rabbinic prohibition instead of a core Torah prohibition. And this Mishnah is actually a direct copy from a Mishnah in Avodah Zarah, which is about the relationship between Jews and non-Jews, brought here because the topic under discussion is now basically different customs in different places. Okay. So now we're getting back to Pesach, but again, a sort of regional differences. Apparently, some places have the custom to eat roasted lamb or roasted meat on Seder nights. And in those places, you can certainly eat it. But in a place where they do not eat, they do not generally eat roasted meat on Seder nights, then you should not eat it. Seems like the concern is that roasted meat, the Paschal offering, the actual korban you would have brought in the temple, would have to have been roasted meat. So it seems like you might be accused of doing something similar to eating sacred meat outside of the temple. So some people were nervous about that, apparently, and did not allow you to eat roasted meat on the on Seder night, which is true of many Ashkenazim today. Many Ashkenazim will deliberately serve chicken or turkey or something in order not to serve meat or lamb on Pesach, so it doesn't look like it's on Seder night, so it doesn't look like it's your Korban Pesach. And many Sephardim will eat lamb because they're trying to make it look like the Korban Pesach. So it makes a lot of sense, both sides of the argument, but nonetheless, the core of this regional difference is already in the Mishnah. One of the weird things about Pesach, though, this comes to it, which is like Pesach always, Seder night especially, has this sort of weird hybrid home-temple thing going on. Because even in the Torah, it's like very much supposed to be a home ritual, but then there's also sort of temple aspects to it because you have to have a sacrifice. There's like a lot of sort of blurring between the home and the temple, and the home sort of becomes a temple on Pesach. So yeah, there's a lot to say about that. Okay. New thing, totally new thing, unrelated to Pesach. Makom shenahagu lahadlik et haner b'leile yom ha-kippurim, madlikin. Makom shenahagu shelo lahadlik, ein madlikin. So again, new regional difference about on Erev Yom Kippur, about whether you would light a lamp beforehand. Some places you would, some places you would not. It seems like lamp, there could be a couple of things going on. One thing is that you light a lamp before Shabbat and Yom Tov, such that you don't have to light a lamp on those days. So the people who light those lamps might think the Yom Kippur is no difference. You just light your lamps, which we light candles for Yom Kippur today. Or it might be that, and the people who don't want you to light candles, they might think that Yom Kippur is not like other Shabbats and Yom Tovs. It's actually it's sort of its own unique mood, and maybe lighting would take away from the sort of solemn aspects of the day. There's also an aspect of Yom Kippur is forbidden to have sex, and I think they also assume that you would not have sex with the light on. So the people who say that you should light lamps, it might be in order to avoid, make it even harder for sex to happen. Or alternatively, it might be the people who say that you don't light lamps, they might be concerned that, like, the husband and wife will like see each other and then end up having sex anyway. So therefore they'd rather the light be out, in which case, like, you can, you know, pretend that you don't each other exist in order to avoid ever coming close to violating the prohibition of sex on Yom Kippur. But you don't have to do it in, so you can't do it, this is about in the houses, but you actually would light lamps elsewhere. Madlikin uvatei knesiot uvatei midrashot uvimvor ta'af ha'feilim va'al gabei ha'cholim. But you would light lamps in the synagogues and the study houses and in the dark alleyways, and because of, and for sick, for people who are sick. Point being is these are public places, right? If you're on the if you think the argument is about how to avoid having sex, we can assume that that's not a problem in a place that isn't an intimate setting between the husband and the wife. And also the Mavod Af Elim is basically just saying, like, yeah, dark alleyway is basically saying, yeah, obviously you have to keep the street lights on. People need to be able to get to shul and back safely. So you need to keep the street lights on. And, you know, cholim, people who are sick, you don't need to go to such a strong length. If they want a candle, if they want a lamp to be on for them, they should be able to have a lamp. Mekom shenahagu la'asot malacha b'tisha ba'av, osin. Mekom shenahagu l'shelo la'asot malacha, ein osin. So again, there are some places where you would cease all your work on Tisha B'Av, and some places where you would not. And again, if wherever place you are, you just follow the local custom. But here's a new element which wasn't present in the other ones, which is that there's one thing which is not regional dependent. If you're a Torah scholar, then you should certainly not do any work on Tisha B'Av. Honestly, I think that doing work on Tisha B'Av is like the thing that makes Tisha B'Av actually so much harder than Yom Kippur. Because on Yom Kippur, you just like go there and you go to shul and you like have a thing to do all day and you are focused on that. And you can basically forget about, in my experience, you can forget about fasting. But then when you're like on Tisha B'Av and you're going about your normal day, that's actually like the worst thing to do when you're fasting. Here is the next thing. Right, so that's the Talmidei Chachamim. The Mishnah thinks that they would always be not doing their work. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, le'olam ya'aseh adam atzno talmid chacham. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, actually, everyone should be aspiring to be a Torah scholar in this way. Everyone should be aspiring to not do work on Tisha B'Av, regardless of where you are. That's the end of our sort of miscellaneous collections of regional differences here. And now we're going to get back to the topic at hand. And we're going to learn about which regions did work on Pesach until noon and which regions did not do any work on Pesach. We're now going to move on to that. So we're going to come back to our topic of Mishnah 1. There are multiple regions in Eretz Israel. Judah and Galil are the two main regions that people talk about. So Judah, the area around Jerusalem and the hills, and then the Galilee up north. And those are, they often have different laws that apply in Judah or Galilee, or different customs, or in the Galilee. So here we're going to find out. Chachamim omrim, Bihuda hayu osin malacha ba'arvei psachim ad chatzot, uva'galil lo hayu osin kolikar. So it turns out that when it said in Mishnah 1, this is one explanation, there are other explanations in this Mishnah, but I'm just going to give you this one, which I think is the cleanest. When we said in Mishnah 1, that there are some places that do work until noon and some places that don't do work at all on the 14th of Nisan. Well, let me tell you, Judea is the place where they did work until noon, and the Galilee was a place where they did no work at all. But then we know that the regions we're talking about is going from Judah to Galilee or vice versa. Now we have a disagreement which seems to be about specifically the Galilee, which is to say that if the Galil didn't do work all day, does the work include the night before? And that's the topic of this debate now. The Halayla, Beit Shammai Osrin, Uveit Hillel Matirin, Ad Hanei Tahama. So when it says all day, does it mean including the previous night? Beit Shammai says yes, it means including the previous night. You can do any work from the night of the 14th until the start of the Seder. And Beit Hillel thinks that you can't do any work from noon. Sorry, you can't do any work from sunrise. So they're just basically sort of arguing what does day mean here? Normally day means, you know, the whole day means the night before as well, but sometimes it only means the morning. For example, like fast days that start at dawn and go until dusk, That would be an example of a day which only really starts at sunrise. That was our lovely little collection of different regional customs in Mishnah 8 times. We're going to move on to Mishnah 6. We'll probably end here for today. We may end in the middle. We'll see how it goes. Rabbi Meir Omer. Kol malacha shehitchil ba kodem la'arba asar, gomera ba'arba asar, aval lo yatchil ba batchila ba'arba asar, afal pi sheyachol la'gomera. Rabbi Meir, now we're sort of trying to drill down the parameters of what does it mean to say that you can't do any work on the 14th. Rabbi Meir says that you can, any work which you started before Arba Asar, you can then finish it on Arba Asar. So I don't know, you had bread, well, you can have bread rising. You had like, cloths dyeing or something. You started that in the previous day, you can sort of finish that on the current day, or like you were in the middle of chopping wood, you whatever, those things you can continue doing, sort of your daily activities. But you can't start something on the 14th, even if you would in fact be able to finish it all on that day. I guess it seems to be about an orientation of like not starting work, even if it's a short task that you think you could definitely do, you know, within a couple of hours. You don't want to be like taking anything away from your Pesach mindset, like everything has to be ready for Pesach. Now, it's a bit unclear whether this is about the Galil or Yehuda, in the sense of, are we talking about the people who only work until noon, or the people who don't work at all on that day? It's not totally obvious from this Mishnah which one we're talking about. Okay, and then this part of the Mishnah seems extremely relevant for us right now. Chachamim omrim, shlosh umaniyot osin melacha ba'arvei pesachim ad chatzot ve'elu hein. Hachayatim, hasaparim, v'hakovsin. So the majority opinion here adds that there are actually three tradesmen who have to, and craftsmen who have to continue doing their work on the 14th until noon. Which this is basically like a list of essential workers. It seems to me, right? Many of us are at home, but essential services are still open, and people are going to work. And the essential services here seems to be because some of these things, their default assumption is that even on Chol Moed, you would shut your business down, but during the 7 days of Pesach, no one would really be working at all. That's their default assumption. But there are some people who you would actually have to continue doing their work during Chol Moed, and these are also these people. So it seems like that's these people and sometimes others, but it seems like this is related to that. So that's sort of tailors and barbers and launderers. This is all part of the preparation for Chag. Yeah, so the question is, what about grocery stores? So this is specifically about craftsmen and not about jobs in general. It seems like you would still be able to get your food on Pesach on the 14th. Okay, and then the last thing here is Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda Omer, Af Haratz Anim. Also shoemakers, cobblers. Is that what they're called? Yeah, cobblers. So these are things that you might need in order to go into the festival with, nice haircuts and clean clothes and repaired clothes and nice shoes. Exactly, lichvod hachag, exactly right. Okay, thank you everyone.